The House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water will come to order. Colleagues, we have a couple of things on our agenda today. We are going to start with an informational meeting on solar siting and farmland. I'd like to call forward. We're going to call forward Richard Whitman and Marilyn Morix. Colleagues, you may remember the discussion that we had during the interim legislative days regarding the siting of solar projects, and at that time it was called, I believe, LC 122. Is that correct? And the discussion that we had around that bill, this is a follow-up to that discussion. And Mr. Whitman, if you care to kick off, that would be fantastic.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bailey, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Whitman, Governor Kitzhaber's natural resource advisor. I was in the back of the room during your informational hearing in the interim on this subject, so I heard the same testimony that you all heard on this issue. And there have been discussions since that hearing among some of the interest in terms of both the land use issues and in terms of the solar industry. Just to frame this a little bit and give you a little bit of context, recall that LCDC, the Land Conservation and Development Commission, Marilyn Warwick's with me today as the chair of that commission, undertook a rulemaking to make it easier to site solar facilities on farmland. They expanded the acreage so that bigger facilities could be sited. The issue that you heard about in your last hearing was that the expansion was from 20 acres to 100 acres on what are called non-arable lands, which folks from eastern Oregon will talk about in terms of, you know, being those rocky lands that aren't really good for anything. So there's been discussion that 100 acres really isn't large enough to accommodate some of the larger solar facilities that are being considered. The governor's very interested in seeing the solar industry develop in the state. We want it to be done in a responsible manner, though. But the governor's position on this is that he would support and is requesting that the Land Conservation and Development Commission reopen their rulemaking and consider an increase in the acreage for solar facilities that are allowed on non-arable land from 100 acres to 250 acres. And the governor would recommend that that change be made in the rule. And that's the purpose of my testimony here today. We believe that's an appropriate balance for those lands in eastern Oregon. So with that, I'll turn it over to Marilyn.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marilyn Warwick. Over 20 years ago, I sat on your side of the podium as Marilyn Dell. This is the first time I've been here, back here on this side. And what that means is I know the importance of being brief. And so I just want to reiterate that personally, I cannot speak for the commission, but personally, I'm strongly in favor of adjusting the criteria from the 100 acres to 250 acres, provided it's on non-arable land. I think if we do that, we give the flexibility that's needed in this area, but we give a much clearer and more certain path for people who are trying to do this kind of siting by keeping the existing rule and making that change. So personally, I would support it, and personally, I would try to get the commission to move as quickly as possible to remedy it.
Thank you. Committee, questions for this panel?
I have a question.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had a discussion last time about whether that 250 or whatever the acreage was would encompass land that was just for the solar facility or whether that would be the entire land, knowing that some of the land probably couldn't be used for the facility. So I wonder what your definition of the 250 is.
Co-Chair Bailey, Representative Kenny Geyer, the specifics of how the area of the solar facility is counted in terms of acreage doesn't appear in the land conservation and development rules. There is precedent, though, in terms of how the Energy Facility Siting Council, mm-hmm. which looks at the bigger facilities, would consider that. So there's some guide to go on there. Basically, you would draw a box around the photovoltaic facility, and if there is a transmission line required to take it out to a substation or to another existing transmission line, that right-of-way corridor for the transmission would be counted. So it would be those two things.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Representative Vince.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Richard, for that effort that the governor's taking. I really do appreciate that, and I understand the challenge that goes with dealing with parcels of 250 acres. I spent part of the 7.5 hours I spent driving over here thinking about how I might express the size of the rest of the state to those that are captured in this valley. And maybe they were to be constrained mentally by the nature of this small little valley where 100 acres still amounts to something. It doesn't. My district is 29 million acres. And to say that those acres are really not good for anything would be incorrect. They're good for a lot of things if we can just somehow break through the self-imposed bonds that I think fit the situation here in the Willamette Valley very, very well. To say that my land, most of it is not arable, would be the understatement of the century. And to say that 250 acres should be in play, is I'm not sure where that comes from. I really don't. So maybe I should ask that, but sure. I want to impress the importance of this issue upon all those listening. It's a big deal to us, mm-hmm. and it's not right that we would take the Willamette Valley view of I don't have the number of acres of Willamette Valley yet, but those that are left are relatively small compared to 29 million, and I don't know how many Willamette Valleys fit in my district. Four? I have no idea, but the point is, we seem to be using the wrong measure. So maybe you could express to me why 250 acres in my part of the world, where some ranches are 50,000 acres, just one ownership.
Right. So, Co-Chair Bailey, Representative Bentz, the reason for that acreage is that you heard from the solar industry folks that is the largest acreage that they expect to be developed in the near future. I also need to point out that this is not a hard cap of 250 acres in terms of siting. You can go above 250 acres. You can go as big as you want. 250 acres is about a third of a square mile. You could have a larger solar facility if you wanted to, but you would have to go through the exception process in order to do that. So this is not a hard, you can't go above. The rule previously also had that same distinction in terms of an exception. It just requires more analysis if you're going to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to make it clear, I appreciate the movement from 100 to 250. I don't want to understate that. It's still a bunch of space.
Yes.
What I also understand is that we are about to close the Boardman coal-fired facility, and I say about because in terms of, 8 years? Yeah. And the amount of time it takes us to build replacement power is important, and we can't just snap our fingers. So this 8 years is pretty important. To get a goal amendment is going to take between 2 to 3 years. And the, as I understand, the federal credit that you're relying upon of 30% goes away in about 4 years. So this activity that your commission is going to be working on, extraordinarily important to us. So I hope it happens. I want to make that really clear. I'm happy for the movement from 100 to 250. I would be happier if we would recognize for my part of the world that we wouldn't have to go through the goal accession process if someone wants to come in and put in a bigger space. I want to go back to your remark that 250 acres is about a third of a square mile. My district is 29,000 square miles. Mm-hmm. 29,000, so a third of a square mile, it's not very big over there. And there are spaces that lend themselves to this kind of development. I'm just saying. And so I appreciate the movement. I certainly would appreciate more. But in the short run, if you can get that much done and possibly leave the door open to moving closer to 1,000 acres, we would very much appreciate it from my part of the state. Thank you.
Can I make a comment? Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, the Commission is very sensitive to the comments that you just made. In recent years, we've made it a practice to travel throughout the state for our Commission meetings, not sit in Salem, not just sit looking out the window at the Willamette Valley. So we are very sensitive to the fact that arable land is different, the size of operations is different, because we went there to look and see and understand the differences. And it's one thing that makes it easier to go to the 250. Yes, there's a lot more to be done to recognize the differences between the Willamette Valley and Eastern Oregon, but I do want you to know that the Commission is really sensitive to the comments that you just made, and we're looking for ways to close that gap.
Thank you.
Thank you. Vice Chair Krieger.
50,000 acre ranch, like he says, isn't that uncommon over there. A lot of them, they're smaller, but still huge compared to the valley. And I haven't been able to analyze this or look at all the administrative rules. You got 250 acres. How about 250 here, 50 feet, another 250 units, 258. How many of those 250s can one ownership have lined out along an access line?
Co-Chair Bailey, Representative Krieger, I do not believe the rule, and Michael Morrissey is here from the department. He may be able to give you a more exact answer, but I do not believe the rule speaks to that exact question. Again, this is an issue that comes up before the Energy Facility Siting Council in terms of multiple phases of projects, and they have rules which I would expect would be more or less the same thing that the Land Conservation and Development Commission would look at in deciding this issue. That's the best answer I can give you right now. We'd be happy to look into it and get you a specific
answer. I would like to know that as to a single ownership, and then you may have an area where you got three or four ownerships coming together, and the source for transmission is there.
Yep.
So although it might not be one, you may have three or four very close together of 250 acres. And if you would allow that because they're different ownerships, why wouldn't you allow one to have three sites of 250 acres?
We'll get you an answer.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Along that same line, I too am a little concerned about the 250 from the standpoint that if I want to do a 300 or 700, there's a mechanism for me to apply to do that. It seems to me if we are as dedicated to alternative energy as we claim we are, we would want to open that door and be a little bit more proactive. And in following up on Representative Benz, I don't even know if I could buy 250 acres out of the huge tracts of land that exist out there. Mm-hmm. I would think it would be a better image for the state to open this up to 1,000 and let somebody build 250 on 1,000. But when the guy comes along who wants to build 1,000, we're willing to do that without a bureaucratic application process that'll tie this up for, you know, we don't have a great image in this state for the way we deal with land use exceptions. I mean, it would be much more beneficial to attracting that industry if we opened that up more, and I'm suggesting 1,000, and let people know that we really are open to the solar industry, unless there is some reason that would be detrimental. And if we're saying you can have 250 or you can apply and go through the hoops for 700, doesn't make any sense. Why put the hurdle in there if we have in process a way to approve that? We're not saying we're short of land, therefore you may only have 250 and there's no possibility of anything else. What I'm hearing is it's quite possible to go to a larger piece. So, let's do it. And there may be a few jackrabbits upset temporarily, but they're very adaptable. Mm-hmm. And I think if I'm looking at the same land that Representative Benz is looking at, the number of cows per acre turns quickly to number of acres per cow. We're not talking about land productive for a whole lot of else, and we aren't talking about endangered land. There's plenty more not built on. of similar type. So I would think as an image of the state, we want to be more expansive and really put the image out there that we truly are looking for alternative energy development and bring it on, as opposed to putting artificial hurdles in that are going to cost somebody a lot of money to get around.
Thank you, Representative.
If I could, Co-Chair Bailey, just briefly, this is a good discussion. The points that you make are good ones. Again, part of the reason of the Commission undertaking this rule was to open the door further for this particular industry. They did a similar rulemaking earlier for the wind industry. The broader point I want to make is the governor is working on a 10-year energy plan right now, and we are looking comprehensively at all the thresholds, regulatory thresholds for renewable energy, and likely we'll be back before you in 2013 with some recommendations looking at the whole picture as a collective. How do we get to where we want to go and where you have expressed you want to go in terms of renewable energy future for this state? So we are looking at this comprehensively. It's that effort's not done yet, so I don't have specifics for you today, but I think you'll be hearing more about this subject in your next session.
Thank you. Co-Chair Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and welcome, both of you. If I understood your comment right, you've been up here. The numbers change in the districts, but the areas don't change. Where did you represent?
I'm from McMinnville.
Okay. Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
I've been here 2.5 terms, Mr. Chair, and I've got a short list of slogans that I particularly dislike. And the first one is, we'll fix it on the Senate side. And the next one would be, and it happens to me a lot, as my colleagues know, your comments are not germane. And now I have a new one, and I think it's largely because of this situation. We'll fix it in rule. So I'm a little frustrated that we are still here talking about this. I don't completely, even after having heard the discussion in the interim, I don't completely understand why we didn't fix it in rule. I know it's complicated. I know there are stakeholders, yada, yada. But I don't know why we didn't fix it in rule. And then I also want to make a comment that you're welcome to comment on yourself regarding the larger picture. This issue has shined a light on a specific kind of development, and I don't think we've resolved that. In fact, I think the more we drag our feet and go through this, we're driving that particular industry and development away. But the larger light is, what is our policy? Where are we headed? I know that you're in the natural resource area, but it's an integral part of the way this state moves forward. So how is this kind of activity, these kind of policies, going to affect other developments? I believe this governor loves the state of Oregon, and he wants to protect our natural resources. I also believe he's part of a team that's trying to create jobs in Oregon. Mm-hmm. This one, for me, this may not be the largest industry in the world, for me, this one is one where we can all come together for a number of small jobs. So that's a whole lot there. But I'll do a follow-up, but I'll stop there, and if you'd like to comment, I'd appreciate it.
Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Gilliam, the governor agrees with you. This industry in particular, the renewable energy industry, is an integral part of the future of the state of Oregon. Oregon is already number 4 in the nation in terms of wind energy development. We want to be a leader also in solar energy development. We're also currently a leader, although it's very early in development right now, in wave energy development along our coast. So we're working in a number of arenas to promote renewable energy in the state of Oregon. The legislature has adopted a pretty aggressive renewable portfolio standard for utilities in Oregon, and we're on track, I'm happy to say, to meet that. So this is a win-win situation, I think, for natural resources, for the farming community in eastern Oregon, where there's another opportunity to earn revenue here in terms of jobs. This is an important job generator, particularly the wind industry in certain parts of the state. So I agree with you. I think this is an area where we can all come together and agree that this is an industry that we want to promote in the state of Oregon.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Okay, that's great. Now, how do we get ODF&W, the Energy Siting Council, the Commission, and the Governor's Office to start pulling together quickly if we are trying to help this industry? Because I can assure you they're frustrated. And they're to the point now where it's like, you know what? How many acres are we going to have to manage or buy just to put up one, I'll call it product, one square structure that collects the sunlight? The next thing I want to get into, and before I do, I want to go back to Representative Benz. This is just a plea. As you move forward on your energy plan or any other natural resource plan, please listen to this representative. Mm-hmm. There's all of us, and then there's the representative for the other half of the state. Right. And he speaks the truth. Mm-hmm. I drive from all the way from Silverton every day to this Capitol. And he's right. And he has a lot more time to think as he's coming. He's dedicated to that part of the state. And we cannot forget them, not just because they're part of the state, but because they have a perspective. So please listen carefully to his words. But I want to specifically ask you about, and if I'm mischaracterizing this, you can feel free to correct me, but the issue of the wildlife section of this rule, either I wasn't paying attention or we didn't communicate it, seems to me to be a whole new hurdle. And I don't want to believe that it's purposely set there to push this back. But I'm frustrated by it. And how many acres do we have to set aside to get something done and get a few jobs in eastern Oregon? And how much is that wildlife section in the rule of this specific one part of what we need to face every time we do a development in the eastern part of our state?
Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Gilliam, there is a wildlife component of this rule. There was a wildlife component of what this industry had to go through before this rule was adopted. Before this rule was adopted, if a developer was going to go over those lower thresholds, they would have to do it as a plan amendment. And that would have triggered review of what are called Goal 5 resources, which include wildlife. So this is the commission adopted this particular aspect of the rule as an expedited way of addressing wildlife concerns. And basically what it does is it requires the developer to enter into a discussion with ODF&W about what the impacts of a particular proposal are. If they can't come to an agreement about how to resolve that, it's left in the hands of local government to decide how that's resolved. So it's providing local control on that particular issue. More broadly on the wildlife issue, part of supporting this industry and its long-term future in the state of Oregon is figuring out how to grow it in a way that is compatible with our natural resources. We are under a serious threat in Representative Benz's part of the state of a listing in the future of sage grouse. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has determined that a listing is warranted. They are making noises that they're very serious about that. And so part of this effort in terms of working in the energy plan is to bring the ranching community together with the energy community, together with the wildlife folks, to all agree on what that long-term future looks like, including a major expansion of the renewable energy industry, but in a way that we're protected from some of what our colleagues in federal government might be interested in doing in a few years. So that's the big picture on this.
Another follow-up, Coach, of course. Okay, I keep bouncing around. Let's go back to this situation. What is your view of what is possible
in a reasonable short, reasonable I mean short period of time, to move this particular situation forward to production?
Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Gilliam, I think this rulemaking can be undertaken and completed in a matter of a few months, and we can get that increased acreage on the books, and we can get, as we understand it, you know, projects that are, all the projects that are commercially viable at this point in terms of photovoltaic into this process and moving forward.
And one more, if you'll indulge me. I really hate to hold California up as an example in anything. But, dude, are you aware of how far along they are in this issue? And if you're not, I'd be happy to show you information that's been given to me that might be really helpful to us in moving forward. And I that's not true of all issues, but this is one where we might be able to learn from our southern neighbor.
Representative, or Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Gilliam, I am, and we're looking very carefully at what's going on in California, both from a regulatory side and from a market side, in terms of opportunities to grow this industry in Oregon.
Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I got carried away earlier on the number of acres. Roughly 30,000 square miles, roughly 19 million acres in my district. When we talk about the 250 acres and the sage-grouse, I've got to hear a lot about the sage-grouse as we talked about the Boardman-Hemingway power line, and we are moving it around to circle every LEC in sight, and I understand the need to do that, but there's a lot of space over there where there aren't sage-grouse, never have been sage-grouse, won't ever be sage-grouse. So there's a level of additional time that we impose upon all these projects when we wave the sage-grouse at it or whatever else we might have to wave over there. And so Co-Chair Gilliam's remark about the way to get around those issues when they're truly non-existent would be really helpful. Again, I hate to go back to the raw number of acres involved, but there's a lot of space, surely enough for the sage-grouse and for some of these projects. Much larger than the 250 acres, although I want to again point out I'm very happy for that movement and love to see more.
Okay. I'd like to take the chair's prerogative and make a couple of comments myself as well. A wise man once said to me, and he's actually sitting down at the end of this dais, that if you're going to destabilize any very complex system, you ought to be sure of where you're going before you start taking it apart. And I think part of the challenge that we have had here, certainly in my short time in the legislature, is that in a relatively brief amount of time, we have taken a system and attempted to shift it from a regime and a paradigm that we saw in the earlier part of the last decade to one that we're not sure exactly where it's going to end up. But we know that a clean energy future is important. We know that it's important to build industries and jobs in this state that are critical not only to our environment but to employment, to our community. And this committee last session heard, and with apologies to the folks sitting in the back of the room from the Department of Energy, a bill that unfortunately began with abolishing the Department of Energy. But the point of that bill was to catalyze the discussion and was meant in no way against these fine people in particular, against their agency, but to catalyze a discussion about how we elevate the planning for this process and how we start to coordinate the different pieces that the state has. Because I think what you're hearing is the frustration that many of us have and that I share with many of my colleagues about how we have a coordinated and planned strategy for addressing our climate challenge, for addressing our jobs challenge, and for making sure that we're including communities and wildlife considerations and other development considerations as we do it. I don't think we have a great strategy for how we do it yet, and we're pinning a lot of hopes on your 10-year energy plan and the strategy. And it's my hope that you're putting the kinds of resources and time into it that are necessary to resolve these kinds of thorny issues at the most fundamental level. Because if we don't start to have the right hand knowing what the left hand's doing under a coordinated strategy, then we are going to be in a place where we're looking at, for a very specific example, how sage grouse are affected by solar panels or wind turbines without considering, for example, the effect of climate change on sage grouse habitat. And if we aren't mindful in how we do that planning, if we aren't balancing carefully along with the economic and community development needs of this state, then we're going to continue to have these kinds of challenges as we go forward. So it's my intention that, and I want to echo Representative Bence's comments, that I'm appreciative of the flexibility and the movement and the acreage. I don't think this discussion is anywhere close to being over. I think that we are, while it is a frustrating sentence to say we'll deal with it in the interim, I think we have to commit ourselves, not in the long run, but in the short run, to working very hard to get this right, because siting is just one of these thorny issues that's out there. And if we don't balance the entire picture, then it's going to lead to conflicts that aren't partisan in nature, that aren't urban in nature, that aren't rural in nature, but are a fundamental part of who we are as Oregonians, where we want to go with our clean energy future.
So. Thank you.
May I? I appreciate your comments, Chair Bailey. There's a difference, I think, between coordination, which you refer to, and impeding bureaucracy, which none of us are looking for. But as chair of the commission, I've watched this go from 20 acres, which was certainly not workable, to 100, and still I feel comfortable with the 250. But as we move forward, we do want to make sure that it's not only coordinated with the 10-year energy program, but that it also functions smoothly with Goal 5 resources. We don't want them to be an unreasonable impediment, but it is an important part of our overall plan for the state. And so, not to move too quickly, if we have the 250 acres, we have, in the last round of goal of rulemaking, clarified some of the Goal 5 issues, when they apply and when they do not. That should be helpful to counties because they know a little better what they're going to be looking at. So sometime helps coordination. Too much time and dragging of feet is impeding bureaucracy. None of us want that, certainly not the commission.
And thank you for that comment. At the risk of prolonging the discussion even longer, I would close by saying that I think I can speak for many when I say that to err on the side of too quickly is probably better than erring on the side of too slowly. And whether you care about jobs or whether you care about climate change or you care about both of those things, we have to move very quickly. So thank you for coming before the committee today. Okay. And with that, we will close the informational meeting on solar siting on farmland. And we are going to open a public hearing both on House Bill 4038 and House Bill 4079. And Beth, do you want to take a shot at this, or would you like me
to
frame?
No, I will give it a shot.
Okay. Colleagues, I urge you to pay close attention on both of these, because we're going to move quickly through what is a fairly complex set of arrangements on these two bills. And suffice to say, as an initial framing comment before we get going, one of the perhaps most disgusting phrases in the legislature is the gut and stuff. But the both of these bills will be gutted and stuffed with amendments. Ignore what you see necessarily on the page here, and it will all be taken care of in amendments. So we're going to go through what's happening with these two bills.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, just to set sort of the stage for this, there are two bills in front of you today. House Bill 4038, as it is currently drafted, modifies a number of different statutes related to income and excise taxes. It removes a requirement for the submission of jobs-related data by applicants for energy tax credits, modifies the definition of transportation project, clarifies provisions for application to reserve credits on behalf of a residential property owner for an energy device installation, and authorizes legislative appropriations in lieu of issuance of a film or video tax credit. As House Bill 4079 is currently drafted, it directs the Oregon Department of Energy to submit a report to the legislature on some of the energy tax credit changes, program changes that were made during the 2011 session. Chris Olenek from Legislative Revenue is here to explain in greater detail the series of amendments that are being drafted, which should be available either tomorrow or early next week, hopefully Monday. But there will be five amendments coming towards you, the first of which will take all of the energy tax-related provisions of House Bill 4038 and move them, with changes, move them into House Bill 4079. It will also, there'll be a second amendment to 4038, which makes some changes to the provisions which will remain in that bill, including a separate amendment which will add provisions from the transparency bill from 2011 to the tax credits remaining in 4038, which to which those provisions were not applied during the 2011 session. House Bill 4079 will then have two amendments to it. The one first will be to bring the energy tax credit provisions into it from 4038 with the changes, and then a second amendment which would also apply the transparency law bill from last session to those tax credits. So five amendments in all, and you can, Chris is here to go through the details of each.
Chris, would you come forward, please? And before you begin, let me see if, colleagues, I can sum up very quickly what the issue is here and why we're doing it in the way that we're doing it. The background here is that we have a number of technical fixes to the omnibus tax credit bill that was passed at the end of last session, House Bill 3672, and those fixes crossed, that bill covered a range of tax credits, some of which were related to energy and the environment, some of which were not. This committee began the process over the interim of identifying what technical fixes needed to happen to the energy and environment portions of the tax credits. However, at the same time, the Revenue Committee was drafting a bill that dealt with the entire scope of all of the credits and the technical fixes that needed to happen. That bill from the Revenue Committee ended up here in this committee. This is the Energy and Environment Committee. So we are taking the energy and environment portions of the tax credits out of that larger bill and putting them into their own piece so we can deal with it as a committee and sending it on. And then the remaining portions are the portions that aren't energy and environment related outside the scope of this committee that will remain in the existing bill that came from the House Revenue Committee. I know that's confusing. At the same time, now to make it really complicated, there was the transparency bill that we passed in the last session. It passed prior to the passage, and I'm looking at Chris to make sure I'm getting this right. It passed prior to the passage of House Bill 3672, so it was not included in the tax credits that were then changed in the omnibus bill. So in order to apply the transparency provisions that this legislature passed in the last session to those tax credits, we have to now do that in these bills. And because we're splitting them into two pieces, those transparency portions have to be applied twice. Finally, there's an issue with farm worker housing, which we'll hear testimony on today. The bill on tax credits is a vehicle for that issue. And so we will hear testimony on that particular amendment. So all told, we will have five amendments to two bills. Two amendments to 4079 that will put in the energy and environment tax credits and the transparency amendment, and three amendments to 4038 that will put in the re-put in the remaining tax credits, the transparency amendment, and the farm worker housing tax credit issue. And we have separated those amendments so that the committee has the opportunity to comment on and vote on each of those amendments independently. Does that make sense? Okay. Chris.
Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. You should have a handout in front of you. It's two-sided. The one side says amendments to House Bill 4079 and 4038. And in an attempt to maintain clarity in all of the changes that are going on, how I tried to organize this was on each side there is what, for example, what each bill may look like depending on the pleasure of the committee and how the amendments that you choose to adopt or not. And so the first side is House Bill 4079A. I have that in quotes. May contain the following tax credits. And these are the six credits that, following what the description that Beth and Co-Chair Bailey just described, would appear in this bill. And they are the renewable energy credit, the transportation credit, a residential energy credit, biomass credit, manufacturing Betsy, and conservation. And so what I've done in the table here is just list each of the changes that are either in the existing House Bill 438, and if they are, that right-hand column identifies the section in that bill that you could find those, the specific wording changes, or they will be showing up in the amendments that you've heard about. So I can just march through each of these and provide a little more detail.
I think that would be helpful.
Okay. Starting with the renewable energy, this is a tax credit that the credits get sold by via an auction, and the money raised by the Department of Energy and Department of Revenue gets put into a renewable energy fund, and from that fund, grants are awarded for renewable energy projects. The first change is a clarification of the term award. In statute that was passed in 3672, that term was used two different ways. This just clarifies what is meant by award. The second change, the confirmed language, confirm that the language allows for partial credit and partial appropriation. With 3672, there were two credits, and the other one is also included here later on, that the state has decided to sell via auction. And this is a new policy for the state where the Department for the Renewable Energy, the Department of Energy and Revenue get together and they auction off the credits at a value of no less than 95%. So the way this credit auction was run, taxpayers could buy a $1,000 credit and they had to bid at least $950 for that credit. And then the money raised went into the renewable grant fund. There was also language that allowed the assembly to appropriate money directly to that fund. Now the auction for this credit was held, there have been a couple of them in 2011, and up to $1.5 million in credits could have been sold, but only $500,000 in credits were sold. So that left a situation where, having sold a third of the credits, $1 million could be appropriated into the fund. And it wasn't clear in the language that was adopted in 3672 whether appropriating money into the fund would then require that those tax credits be refunded. Basically, the language here says, okay, you've sold $500,000 in credits, you can appropriate $1 million. So you can have a mix of selling the credits and appropriating money into the fund. The third element here, the remove jobs data requirement. This is language that was left over from the prior Betsy. And for large projects, there was a lot of information required on tracking jobs, as everybody has commented and aware, jobs is a driving policy factor. And for a lot of the large projects under Betsy, it made a lot of sense to keep and track jobs data. But for the credits that came through the other end here in 3672, a lot of these are smaller projects that don't really make a lot of sense to track the jobs data because you get a lot of paperwork burden for tracking the credit. So that just removes that language and removes that requirement. So those three are in 4038. The next three would be in the amendments. And the first line and the fourth item there, page 1, line 18 of House Bill 4038, is just changing the word may to shall. And it refers to when the Department of Energy shall revoke a credit. Makes it mandatory rather than permissive. The next item, clarify expiration date of 7/1/14. The remaining Betsy credits, the Betsy program sunsetted last year, and there are a number of pre-certification credits that are still on the books that could potentially be used. And when 3672 got drafted, the transportation credit and conservation credits had an expiration date of 7/1/14. Now, I apologize, I'm used to talking to the Revenue Committee, so I think I might be jumping around a little bit in terms of clarity here. The old Betsy was sunsetted, but it was broken up into four credits moving forward. You have renewable energy credit, transportation credits, conservation credits, and the manufacturing credits. So those four credits are moving forward. They are structured somewhat similarly, but the amounts of the credits or the total amount of credits that can be certified are less. And so that expiration date refers to renewable energy credits from the old Betsy, not the new credit moving forward. It doesn't change the sunset for the existing credit. It's just the old credits that were existed under Betsy. Then the sixth item there, it allows the credit to be auctioned after the tax year, but before April 15th of the following year. This came about, again, because the renewable energy credit auction only sold about a third of the potential credits. So there was some question as to whether or not another auction can be held for tax year 2011 credits now that that tax year is over. That language would just make it clear that an auction could be held at the end of the tax year, but before April 15th, basically when the tax returns are due. That would allow a situation where when CPAs are going through a taxpayer's tax return, it would give the option to buy the credits at that time if the taxpayer could use them.
I'm going to pause you there for a second, Chris, and first check on questions by section here. You're Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm very concerned about the removal of jobs data. Do we in any way make an attempt to bifurcate the reporting requirements so that large firms with large projects and the potential for significant generation of jobs and employment could report, whereas maybe the fraction of a single job wouldn't be?
Chair Bailey, Representative Witt, this just removes it. Now, a little bit of the history here. Under the renewable energy portion of the Betsy, the state was certifying up to $300 million in credits per biennium, and these could be small projects or very large wind projects or solar projects. And under the program moving forward, only $3 million in credits can be sold for a biennium. So it was a cut of 99% for that type of project. And there is a limit of $250,000 per grant out of the fund. So put another way, with $500,000 sold, that would allow for two $250,000 projects. So just removing this, it was presenting some what was deemed to be onerous requirements by industry on tracking a lot of information for not a lot of jobs. But something could be changed to bifurcate that.
And I might add to that, Representative, I think the concern here was that the pilot program on renewable energy was so small, and the dollar amounts were so small, and the projects were small enough that if you're essentially commissioning a $20,000 in-plant study or $30,000 in-plant study on a $60,000 project, then it was overly burdensome to the size of the projects that were applying. So I think the amount of the dollars that we had here were small enough that we were hoping to get the mechanism right and then make it something that was going to be more functional later.
Mr. Chairman, I view these credits as an investment of the taxpayers' money. And one of the measures of successful outcome is jobs generation. And I can tell you that I represent a district where a $20,000 job would be one that would be highly sought after by a number of people. And I think we have reached a point in this state where the need for jobs creation, and the reporting of what the investment of the public's tax dollars is turning back, that this is critical information. And I heard earlier reference to the transparency bill, and I think the public deserves, and the taxpayers in particular, a report on just what it is that the investment of their dollars is generating.
Thank you, Representative. Chris, if you could keep going through here, and I would say focus on those aspects that are policy decisions such as that for the Energy, Environment, and Water Committee. I think some of the more technical revenue aspects can be handled by that committee unless there are specific questions about them.
Okay. Transportation the project, that's just a definition between whether it refers to the entity or the project. It clarifies that it's the project. This one, there's the grant, third from the bottom there, grant authority to DOE to adjust credit amount to manage the cap. Under current law, they can't change, if a situation arises where they have more applications than they have credit dollars to award, they can't change the credit amount. This just grants the department authority to modify this credit amount so that, for example, everybody, all the applicants can get some amount of credit. The next one, there must be a direct or indirect recipient of federal dollars to be eligible for the credit. The idea here is the funding dollars, it's a way to limit or to direct the credit dollars to entities that either receive funding, federal funding directly, or one step removed from those funding dollars. And the rest under the transportation are largely technical fixes.
Questions on transportation? Okay.
For the residential energy, the first one there, the clarification is that third-party installers aren't certified for the credits, are allowed to reserve tax credits. And the other two items are a codification of existing administrative rules.
And the just so I'm clear, the third-party installers allowed to reserve tax credits. The last bullet there, clarify that the relevant date for the device was purchased refers to the purchase by either the homeowner or a third-party installer. This is to ensure that we have a program that's available for a lot of the kinds of programs that folks like to take advantage of, like the Solarized Pendleton or Portland or Salem programs, or some of the programs run by third-party installers in the state. Is that correct?
That's correct, Co-Chair Bailey. There was just some terminology there that needed to be cleaned up.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, is there a wildlife section in the third-party installer of a solar panel in Portland?
Funny you should ask, Representative. You should come to my district and see some of the wildlife there. I bet it would.
I'd rather meet you here.
For the biomass, the two policies there, the first one, it would grant the Department of Energy to limit double-dipping for oilseed processors who would receive the credit. The idea here is for processors of oil seeds, under the old language, it was potential that in the chain of processing these seeds, it was possible that manufacturers could get two credits for basically the same processing, the stream of processing these products. So the idea here was to limit taxpayers to one bite at the apple, so to speak. And the second item there puts a cap of $20 million per year in potential tax credits. We don't expect, under current projections, we don't expect to hit that cap for several years. For example, in 2012, the projected credits were about $6 million. This was just born from prior experience with the Betsy in terms of some sort of safety valve. But those are two policy decisions before the committee. The manufacturing Betsy is, again, just making, this is another case where it has to do with the way bills passed through the assembly last time, House Bill 2523, which moved the manufacturing Betsy from energy to Business Oregon, passed before House Bill 3606, which made some, which contained a lot of cleanup language for the manufacturing Betsy. So this just catches up on that language. And then for the conservation, it's just the jobs data issue again.
Okay, which we will have discussion on in this committee. Thank you. Any more questions on 4079? Okay. We cover on the back on 4038.
Okay, 4038, just really quickly, because these are non-energy issues. These are again, this cleanup language is one related to research and development activities. That credit gets calculated a couple of different ways. The language was added to one of those credits, but not the other one. It just prevents double dipping between credits and deductions for the same activities. The next item, the workers' comp and fire insurance. JTAX committee last time had 20 credits before it. 10 of them were allowed to sunset, and 10 of them were allowed to continue. The fire insurance credit was one that was allowed to continue, but the way that it was drafted, it actually inadvertently eliminated the sunset date for the workers' comp. So this just gets back to the committee's intent. And the film and video policy is similar. They're related to the auction. And then the last one is the farm worker housing credit. extension of that sunset, and I believe some other minor changes.
Thank you, Chris. Any further questions for Chris before we hear from folks on farm worker housing?
I have a question about when the sunset is for the fire insurance and film and video.
Put them on top of here.
They're all 6 years out, is that correct?
January 1st, 2018.
Seeing none, thank you. We'll be back on this. Okay. I'd like to call up Peter Hanley, Doug Riggs, and John McCulley.
While they're coming up, Mr. Co-Chair, I've been sitting here trying to even understand part of this. And it seems to me, with the Revenue Committee, the Special Tax Credit Committee, whatever that was last time, the Energy and Environment Committee, there's only one common denominator causing all the problems.
No. Okay, two.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Doug Riggs, NGRC, here on behalf of the Oregon Opportunity Network, which is a statewide organization representing nonprofits, community development agencies, and we focus on housing for vulnerable populations and low-income populations in Oregon. This is the first time I've been before the Energy Committee to talk about a farm workers' credit, and I really appreciate you guys taking the time to pursue this. I'm going to have the experts talk about the details. But I do want to go over, and I'm passing out a sheet that you'll get here in a moment, talk a little bit about the history of this. This is a bill, an issue that came up twice last year. There were two bills considered. House Bill 2154 made some statutory changes in the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit language to make sure that the Oregon program complied and aligned with the federal program. So we definitional changes for the most part. That went through a series of hearings and passed through the Policy Committee, the Joint Committee on Taxation, the Revenue Committee, the House floor, the Senate, and the whole process. So there's quite a bit of discussion on the general program on farm workers during the Policy Committees and the Revenue Committees in that bill. The second part of it was the extension of the tax credit itself, and that was contained in House Bill 3168. That passed, was heard in the Ag Committee, extensive hearing, lots of testimony, was passed out of the Ag Committee, went to the Joint Tax Credits Committee, and got there very late, and the committee opened up late, and then there were some questions about whether or not we could update or bring some more accountability to the program, and so that's what Peter's going to talk about. So late in the session, literally within the last about 3 weeks of the session, time ran out, the committee closed, and we could not get the actual extension of the tax credit passed. So Senator Burdick and Representative Barnhart sent us into a room and said, you need to get a working group together, sit down with the four state agencies that work on this tax credit, see if there are any measures that can be taken to make sure that we are tracking the credit a little more carefully. We're making sure that we understand the extent of which it's utilized. There's a little more transparency and make sure that it is going into its intended purposes. So we put together a work group which included Oregon Opportunity Network, the Farm Bureau, the Farm Workers, the Department of Revenue, Department of Agriculture, Oregon OSHA, and Oregon Community Housing Services. The result of that series of work groups has been an agreement, and that's what we're bringing here today. It's been a great collaborative process. We believe that the improvements, which Peter will outline, number one, give us more certainty that the tax credit is both needed and accountable. Number two, I think give you some more assurance that you're putting the money in a place that makes some sense. So I think you may have right now the sheet, which I passed out, which is simple, two pages. And I just want to reemphasize that both bills went through a long process last session. We had multiple hearings, the policy committees in which they originated were supported. And this is hopefully an opportunity to dot the I's and cross the T's and move this out. I will say one thing, and Peter will point out that with a lot of these low-income housing tax credits, there's a long lead time. Last year, we passed the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit out of the legislature ahead of the expiration, and that's because it takes 2 or 4 or 6 or 8 years to put together the financing for these projects. The same is true with this program. It takes 5, 6, 7 years to put together the financing for some projects, so the banks need a lot of lead time, and so that's why this is important. So with that, I will turn it over to Peter Hanley to give you some more details.
Thanks, Doug.
co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Peter Hainley. I'm executive director of CASA of Oregon. I'm also a board member of Oregon Opportunity Network, which helped spearhead the effort to pull the different agencies together, as well as ag interests and housers, to try and figure out how we could rectify some of the challenges that came up during the last committee hearings, last session. CASA of Oregon's been developing housing around the state for 23 years. We've developed housing in Mooloolah, Woodburn. We've developed it all up and down the valley, Vail and Nissa. We're looking at projects now out along the coast. Some of the changes that were done last year allows the ability to do processing worker. So the processing worker was allowed in the federal legislation, but it was not allowed in Oregon. So we got that changed last year. So we're looking at some places in Astoria and some of the other fish processing areas and oyster areas. So over the last 7 months, the agencies got together and we went through a number of the items that had come up during the last hearings. And what we found out was that there needed to be some better communication between Oregon OSHA, Department of Revenue, and Oregon Housing Community Services. And so we went through those issues line item by line item to figure out how we could have some better communication. Our friends from the Farm Bureau, Oregon Tree Fruit Growers, Oregon Associate Nurseries also participated in that. And so what we came up with was a better communication regime on when farmers are awarded credits, when the credits are actually awarded by Oregon Housing and Community Services, they're the awarding agency, when those credits are claimed by the Department of Revenue, and how we can track them to make sure that the credits are being properly allocated, properly accounted for, and that there is some accountability in the system. We found that communication was lacking, and so I think we now have a regime where it will take care of that issue. The departments, I gave you a letter that Oregon Housing Community Services drafted talking about the Memorandum of Understanding that they are nearly completing with the other agencies, and that Memorandum of Understanding will outline the issues as I've discussed about some of the better communication and some of the accountability measures. As Doug was saying, it takes a fair amount of lead time to do these projects. The last one we completed was in Madras. It took us a total of 8 years. That's a long time to try and put a housing project together. It's not very cost effective, and so we're trying to get both our federal and state folks better in alignment. The one we're working on now in Boardman has been in the works for 7 years, and so some much needed housing out there. There's a lot of dairy operations. There's a lot of processing plants in the Boardman and the Port of Morrow, and so we're looking forward to getting that open in about 6 months. So I'm going to stop there, and if there's any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Representative Boone.
Thank you. Peter, just maybe I was spacing out, I don't know, but is there any way that we can lower that time frame? I mean, is it the federal issue or is it a state issue? Why does it take so long?
Chair Bailey, Representative Boone, that's the farthest out that we've had to go is the 7 or 8 years. I mean, typically it's 3 to 4 years. Those delays were due to funding challenges, some that happened right about the time of the economic crisis. Part of it around this credit because it was harder to sell the credits when nobody was making any money. Mm-hmm. And so that probably added a couple of years to it right there.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is John McCulley. I'm here representing the tree fruit industry in the state, primarily the fruit growers in the Mid-Columbia area and northeastern Oregon around Milton Freewater. We're here to speak in support of upgrading and continuing the farm worker housing tax credit. It has been very important for the fruit growers in Oregon to have this credit available. As a result, they've been able to greatly improve the housing that they do provide on the farm. A significant portion of farm worker housing is on the farm, and it's an important component of that stock of housing that needs to be available for farm workers. It allows us to not only provide decent housing for workers, but is an economic boon to the state of Oregon because it allows us to attract workers because we have good housing here. And so we think this is a critical program for the state. The housing for farm workers on farm is regulated by OROSHA. We have been through a rulemaking process with OROSHA over the last couple of years, and we know that over the next few years, the housing that is provided on farm must be upgraded to meet federal standards. It is going to be very expensive for farmers to do that, and this tax credit will certainly be of help to those farmers who need to make those upgrades to their housing. And it will benefit not only the workers, but it will benefit the agriculture community as well. So we strongly encourage this measure to move forward in support of the extension of the sunset.
Thank you. Okay, thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Maybe a question.
Put your finger.
What different farms, different types of industries need those workers on the farm the whole year, but there's a lot of them there during harvest time or planting or different things. Is there housing that's sitting there empty when they're not there? They're off doing something else?
Well, Representative Krieger, Co-Chair Bailey, a lot of the farm worker housing that we do is year-round, and in the valley, it's easy to find 10 months of work year-round, whether it's starting off doing trimming early in the year all the way through Christmas trees. In some of the outlying areas, you know, further out as we're going out past Hood River, the Dalles, out into Vail and Ontario, you've got, you know, shorter growing seasons and more specialty crops. You're finding more of the on-farm housing in those areas. Just like in Hood River, you're going to find a lot of on-farm housing. We've done three projects in the Hood River and the Dalles area to serve year-round populations that are working in the orchards and working some of the surrounding agricultural crops. But the community-based projects that we're developing are pretty much occupied year-round. Some have reserved seasonal units, and one of my colleagues will talk about some of his seasonal housing that's in community-based. But certainly in the on-farm, for the cherry harvest, for the apple harvest, down south for pear harvest, you're going to see seasonal occupancy on those on-farm units.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
And that will call up Sean Cleave, Larry Kleinman, and Peggy Woolsey.
Co-Chair Bailey, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this potential amendment to the bill today. For the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. I don't want to be repetitive to what was said by the panel before me. I would like to just reiterate one point that Mr. McCulley made regarding the need for this housing, especially in the Hood River and the Dalles area. Oregon Farm Bureau is a general ag organization. We have over 220 different commodities that are produced in Oregon. Not all of those commodities require hand-picked labor, but some of the items that we all enjoy, pears, cherries, apples, and the like, definitely do require that on-farm labor as a labor housing, as a mechanism to attract a quality employee back year after year. And it is an important economic driver to get those skilled workers to come back to your farm in that seasonal capacity. I can answer Representative Krieger's question. There are some projects in Marion County that I do know of that do have mixed use. For part of the year, they are used for storage, and then the other part, they are used for housing. What we have done as Oregon Farm Bureau and advocates for this type of housing is tried to work with our growers to ensure that we're providing a quality living environment for not only the workers, for the, but for their families as well. And I just like to say that this is a very, very important project and partnership with the state, especially considering some of the conforming language that Oregon OSHA did with conforming with federal statute in order to bring certain standards that will provide costs as the upgrades are made for the existing housing over the next couple years. So, thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Who's up there? Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Bailey, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Larry Kleinman. I'm the Secretary-Treasurer of TECUN, Oregon's Farmworker Union, based in Woodman. We're Oregon's largest Latino organization. I've given you a copy of my testimony, and in the interest of time, I won't read it or do more than summarize it, except to point out two things. First of all, in addition to the economic benefit and the stabilization of the industry and of workers themselves, the Farmworker Tax Housing Tax Credit supports the stabilization, the growth, and the unification of communities. The Farmworker Housing Projects that you may hear about from other folks here in this hearing, I think, contribute greatly in other ways beyond just the economic benefit to employers and to workers. And I just want to point out something that our president, Ramon Ramirez, who couldn't be here today, reminded me of, and this choreography, this panel is a great example of it, is when is the last time that you saw the Farm Bureau and PECUN sitting on a panel agreeing about and in unity about a proposal that's in front of you. And I think that's basically all that needs to be said about the stars aligning, hopefully, that you will be as well a part of to extend the sunset to 2020. Thank you.
Thank you. And we are capturing this on video just so we can prove that Sasquatch does exist. Ms. Woolsey.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Bailey and Gilliam, and esteemed members of this committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Peggy Woolsey. I'm with Tax Fairness Oregon. We didn't have access to the information about the amendments, and so obviously some of the items that we're concerned about might be moot. But I would like to go ahead and hit the high points.
Please.
So that you can then take that into consideration when you're considering the amendments. First of all, we, of course, generally prefer to see direct budget items rather than tax credits. We're not in favor of financing through the tax code. Unemployment remains high, and taxpayers have a right to ask how the expenditures are creating jobs. Because tax expenditures have grown 10% over the last dozen years, that's a deep concern. We need to require more jobs and higher wages and benefits in return for our subsidies. We need to show the public the cost benefits with more accountability. Good Jobs First has a December 2011 report called Money for Something. I've included a link to the site that has the full report. Oregon received a D- from them and ranked fourth from the bottom in job performance and accountability for subsidies. And on the requirement of reporting of jobs, many times the employers are asked to report how many jobs they created. We think a better question would be how many hours of paid labor were involved, because a lot of these jobs that are being created are a number of jobs that are being done by one or two people. And so if we knew how many hours they actually perform doing the jobs for which they're getting credits, maybe that would be a better way to judge the impact. We also think that the switching of the tax credits to grants is a very good move. And it simplifies the reporting for businesses. It also simplifies the agencies who administer these laws. And we think that it could justify a reduction in the amount by as much as 10% because it does simplify on both sides of the equation. And with some amendments, we would love to be able to support this.
Thank you very much. Questions? Co-Chair Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mindful of my friend Representative Witt's comments on this subject, I still want to ask a question, because I can assure you, if I support removing the job-related data, I am not sending a message that I don't care about jobs. But my question, I guess, is at what point is it a diminishing return? Is there a point where it's not worth it? I'm not saying this is the point, but if not, where is it? Because it can cost you more in lots of resources to report than you're getting back. I mean, there's got to be some limit. I don't know where that is. I wonder if you've thought about that.
Well, we did think about it, and that's why we thought maybe reporting that the jobs that they, the hours that they spend on those jobs would be a better way of gauging than trying to figure out how many jobs that compiled.
Sean, did you want to add something?
I can maybe shed a little bit of light, anecdotally at least, regarding some of the conversations I've had with my members who provide this housing. It is a delicate balance, not just a financial balance, but an emotional one. For a producer who has built a relationship with farm workers over generations that are living on their property while they're doing work, those producers do want to continue to provide housing. There is a delicate balance regarding the regulation and the inspection of those homes, to where many producers feel like already it's not worth the continued effort to maintain the properties. And the question that many of them face is, should I remove the housing or stop continuing to offer the housing, force these people I care about to have to drive on a daily basis and put long hours on the farm? I think for my members, they would like to continue to provide that housing into the long-term future. But it is already a delicate balance between offering a benefit for the employee and complying with safety and health regulations within the housing itself. So I would say that adding more regulations, I would be afraid that we may be approaching a tipping point under that conversation. But I would say that a lot of the items that were detailed in the Memorandum of Understanding, which I believe all of you have, do speak to some of those issues that were addressed.
And I just want to thank you for that. And I just want to clarify, too, that I think we might be talking about a couple of different sections of the amendments here on 4038, the danger of trying to move a bunch of different amendments and sections at the same time. Did you?
Yeah.
And then after Representative Krieger.
Sean, I don't know how this works. It may be different. Do the workers pay any type of funds for staying in that facility, or is it part of their pay package and they get paid less per hour? Tell us how that works.
It's a mixed bag, and perhaps Peter Haney might be able to give you a better description of exactly what that looks like. From my understanding, there are the vast majority of producers offer the housing free of charge, especially in competitive areas where you do have to have that skilled labor. It does provide the farmer the ability to say, I can pay a piece rate which will probably average out to $25 an hour, plus I can give you housing for free, whereas a competitor can only say, well, I don't have housing, but I can match that rate. So there's your leg up as far as an employer goes trying to attract and retain those producers. I'm not sure if that completely answers your question, but I would say that I couldn't break it down probably as well as Peter might be able to as to the percentage of free versus low cost versus what components of cost are included in compensation.
Mr. Hanley, did you want to comment on that?
Peter Hanley with Costs of Oregon. I'm not sure I can give you a percentage either. From the research we've done 10 years ago, it was most of the farmers were not charging rent. You know, we charge rent for the community-based projects. They only pay 30% of their labor, or for 30% of their income for a rural development-sponsored project. And then we have other programs that we do where they pay a lower than market rate. But typically the on-farm, from my history, has been that they don't pay, and perhaps Larry has more information. But when we've done survey work at some of the labor camps, we haven't seen where they were charging.
Thank you. Representative Kinnegar.
Co-chair, I was just looking for clarification. There is a requirement for the number of jobs under the farm workers housing as well? Or is it just under the video and film and energy credits? Is it across the board requirement?
Representative, that the jobs requirement is related to the pieces that were formerly known as the Betsy.
Okay.
And
so
the new
not
sections
the farm
that
workers.
Have been split up. So farm workers housing, because it's not particularly a jobs outcome bill per se, I do not believe has that requirement in it, and did not in existing statutes. I believe this portion changes a few, modifies the credit slightly, and mostly focuses on the extension of the program.
And also for clarification, does this go to the Tax Credits Committee?
Funny you should ask, Representative Kinnegar. It actually has a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee.
Okay.
Doesn't matter if it's going to.
Why is that? It's a discussion for another day, Representative.
So this would be the place where we would discuss the proposed amendment to look at hours as opposed to a number of jobs, hours, benefits.
Representative Kinnegar, this would be any policy issue that is not related to the revenue components and the tax credit components of the bill. This would be an appropriate venue to discuss those portions of the bill.
Co-Chair Bailey, Representative Kenny Grewer, nice to meet you. Sean Cleef, Farm Bureau.
Sean, I'm sorry, I interrupted. It's Kenny Geyer.
Geyer, yeah. Geyer. Sorry. Marbles in the mouth. Thank you, Co-Chair. I would say, regarding a question for the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit and a reporting on jobs created, I think it's almost a self-equalization based on the acreage of the farm and how much per bed. You don't want to... your seasons, the number of acres, the type of crop you're producing dictates the size of workforce you need. So it really kind of does self-equalize itself. So,
thank you. Thank you to this panel. And we have one more last edition. Roberto Jimenez, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Roberto Jimenez, Executive Director of the Farm Worker Housing Development Corporation. I've given my comments in writing, so I'll keep them brief. The Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit has been utilized by FHDC to build 188 units of community-based farm worker housing, with another 40 scheduled to be completed this year. The result of this is that approximately 230 families or 1,000 individuals are living in stable, healthy, community-based housing environments. Approximately 90% of these families qualified as homeless prior to living in this housing. Stable farm worker families in Oregon, stable farm worker families means stable labor pool for Oregon's nearly $5 billion agricultural industry, vast majority of that in the Mid-Willamette Valley, where FHDC is located. Oregon is meeting approximately 2% of that demand and about 1% of the demand in the Woodburn area, where most farm workers prefer to live. Nuevo Amanecer Phases 1 and 2 are farm worker projects in Woodburn that have benefited from the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit Program. And yet for 90 units of housing, there are approximately 300 families on the waiting list for that housing with no end in sight. But those families have access to services, medical services, schooling, and all the other amenities of urban living, which they're deprived when they're living outside of the urban growth boundary. I'll leave it at that and take any questions.
Questions? Thank you, sir, for coming to testify. Appreciate it. Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to be heard on either one of these bills or any of these potential amendments? Going once. Okay. Okay, colleagues, well, hopefully that was straightforward and clear to the point. And you can have some appreciation for the fund that we have on revenue. And with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bills 4038 and 4079. And Beth, do we have anything else we need to do?
Nope.
All right. In honor of revenue, we have exhausted our agenda, and the committee is adjourned.
Cool.